Mr. Bruno, good morning to you, and Mr. Olson, good morning to you. Do either council have any questions before we begin?
Not me, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. And just one second, Mr. Bruno, before, so that everybody gets in and out of the courtroom, which I believe has now happened, so you may proceed.
All right, well, thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, students, and faculty. My name is Jason Bruno, and I'm here on behalf of the appellants. We're here asking this court to reverse the decision of the district court and grant summary judgment in our favor, determining that the appellant, Andrew Snyder, breached his duties as my client's attorney. It is undisputed in this case that Mr. Snyder decided to omit parties called citizen objectors to an appeal filing from the denial of their liquor licenses that they've held for upwards of 20 to 30 years. That decision caused this court to dismiss the appeal for lack of jurisdiction in 2017. We would submit that this is obvious malpractice, as proven by Mr. Snyder's email that he sent the same day of this court's decision. That email said, among other things, "We lost because of my error in not including all parties to the appeal. Obviously, this is my fault." Despite that admission, the district court dismissed the case, determining that there was an unsettled issue of law. We would argue that it is ultimately irrelevant whether or not the issue was unsettled or not settled, because we should prevail on summary judgment either way. If there was truly an unsettled issue of law, or Mr. Snyder believed there was an unsettled issue of law, or he simply didn't know, he clearly still had duties to my clients in this case. And I would refer to the Wood decision, where this court said, the attorney should inform the client that the issue is uncertain, unsettled, or debatable, and allow the client to make the decision.
You are aware, I believe, of your opponent's response to that argument, that this court or the law has never gone beyond settlement issues and that disclosure discussion with clients. What is your response?
I am aware and I respectfully disagree. I was just citing the Wood decision out of convenience, but it goes to the basic laws in this case, including an attorney's ethical duty or responsibility to his client, which is to provide that client with any material information related to the representation. And I also don't believe the Wood decision is limited to settlement agreements, and I think the language is much broader than that, and even says that an attorney cannot make a unilateral decision on behalf of his client if there is some unsettled issue. And that is exactly what happened here. There was no warning to my clients of the catastrophic results that could result from a jurisdictional defect, which is exactly what this court found in the case. And this wasn't anything that Mr. Snyder was or could have been blinded by in this case. The citizen objector's position was made very, very clear to him. There were two filings from David Domina, the attorney for the citizen objectors, about a month or so before Mr. Snyder filed his appeal. Mr. Domina told him in those filings that are cited in pages and quoted in pages of my brief, the citizen objectors were our parties of record. They are necessary parties to court proceedings. There is no jurisdiction without them. And Mr. Domina's wasn't rhetoric. He provided supporting authority for his arguments, and he turned out to be right. And for whatever reason, Mr. Snyder ignored the warnings of Mr. Domina and proceeded to file without the citizen objectors, without any discussion with the clients, or without any warning that my clients could lose the appeal.
Is there evidence that he thought through the issues, that he researched the issues, and then he made an informed decision based on his understanding of the law?
There are conclusory statements to that effect, Your Honor, but I don't believe the evidence supports that. If you look at that, he filed this appeal, I think literally the day after the decision came out, and we went out to Minnesota and researched, or we subpoenaed the Westlaw representative to see actually what searches were conducted. You won't see any searches about whether or not you needed to name the citizen objectors. You will see he looked at the statute upon which he cited, which clearly required him to name parties of record, and three others related to the ultimate merits of the case. You won't see any evidence where there was a discussion or research regarding that. And you can't sit there and say, well, I considered everything, but he didn't consider the stuff which he should have, like David Domina's warnings or caution saying, hey, if you do this, I'm going to argue to the court that they should dismiss your client's case because they don't have jurisdiction. He cites the statute in his petition on appeal that says very clearly that you need to name parties of record.
Counsel, with respect to that, you referred at least three times to the statute, but aren't there at least two statutes in play in determining in the COSL one, if you will, who the parties of record are?
But does it, you could take either of those statutes, Your Honor, but Mr. Snyder only cited to one in his petition on appeal filing, and that says parties of record.
That's the Administrative Procedure Act.
Correct. And then if you look at the
But can you understand what that means without looking? Can you understand our original decision in COSL without looking at the liquor control statute?
100% you can. Yes, because it says parties of record. Mr. Snyder knows what parties of record are. He was participating in the proceedings, and he knew that they were parties like anybody else. They had a lawyer. They participated in the proceedings.
Isn't that what COSL 1 was all about? This court trying to decide what parties of record was?
No, because this court already made that decision 3 years earlier in 2014 in Schaefer, where this court rendered the same analysis of the same statute, the Administrative Procedure Act.
Isn't a substantial part of the COSL opinion interpreting the Liquor Control Act?
I think it's analyzing the arguments that were made to it by Mr. Snyder that were rejected, because this court basically said, for all practical purposes, they were a party of record under any way you define it. I don't think the Liquor Control Act supports Mr. Snyder's argument. I actually think it refutes it, because under either statute that he looked at, and I don't think he looked at the Liquor Control Act statute before he filed.
Did the legislature respond with any changes after our COSL decision?
I don't know if they responded to the COSL decision, but they implemented the language that this court basically adopted in 2014 into the statute.
So they made the statute more specific?
Yes. They basically put in the test about this court and how to determine what a party of record is. They participate in the proceedings, basically the same analysis that this court went through in COSL and then 3 years before that. And my point to this entire thing is, even if it is an unsettled issue of law, which we don't think it is, there was still a duty or obligation for Mr. Snyder to call up the clients and say, hey, I don't know what to do here. There's some ambiguity in the statute. So we could either name the citizen objectors, here are the detriments of doing so, which frankly there aren't any, or we could not name the citizen objectors, and here's the detriment of doing so. And I know this because David Domina told me that this court could dismiss your appeal.
If we were to agree with the appellees in their reading of the Wood case, would you point us to some other authority that you argue establishes this duty that Mr. Snyder had to confer with his clients about the risk outside of the settlement?
Sure, I would assert you to the general rules of ethical conduct that require an attorney to keep their client informed of all material information, to be involved in the decision-making process. And I would further cite you to, we have an expert who establishes the specific standard of care in this circumstance. With that being said, I would like to serve the remaining time for rebuttal unless anybody has any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Olson, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Steve Olson. I represent Andrew Snyder and his law firm. We'll start with Wood, and Wood talks about this language. We conclude that the doctrine of judgmental immunity does not apply to an attorney's failure to inform a client of unsettled legal issues relevant to settlement. That was Wood. There are six cases that have come after Wood that have decided the same thing, all in the context of settlement negotiations, starting with the Rice case and going all the way to the Bruning case. So we don't have any case law that sets forth a duty. The next thing we do is look at the ethical rules, and we have the ABA model rules, the Code of Professional Responsibility, and this court's own rules of professional conduct. Those rules set forth a division of authority between client and between a lawyer. and they give certain responsibilities and duties to the client. The client can decide if they want to settle a case or not and on what terms. The client can decide whether they want to spend money on a case and how much money on a case. And over here, we've got the lawyer who is hired because of his skill, his expertise, his knowledge, and he's charged with legal and technical issues. And in the middle, we have those things and the comments to the ethical rules that say that the lawyer is impliedly authorized to continue with the representation in the best interests of that client. So what does impliedly authorized mean? It means something different in every case. Every client is different. Every client has different expectations that they want out of that case. And
in this case, would you describe this as decision of procedural law? How would you describe this?
In terms of the giving notice to a client?
Right.
Well, certainly it deals with procedure, and certainly it touches on ethics because ethics promote communication. But some lawyers don't want to be bothered by those decisions. They say, I hired you for a reason.
Some clients
say, I hired you for a reason. I'm paying you for a reason. Go do your work. You're the expert in the law and then the technical things. And I think that's why the ethical rules have struck that balance. There's nothing in the ethical rules that say this ought to be something that is discussed with a client. And this isn't a short-term relationship between Mr. Snyder and his clients. Mr. Schwarting, one of his clients, and Mr. Snyder, their relationship goes all the way back to before 2006. They've been through this whole process before. Mr. Schwarting applied for a liquor license. He was buying a business from his father. He applied for liquor license. The commission denied that. Mr. Snyder took his case and appealed to the district court and argued that the commission had abused their discretion. And the district court agreed with Mr. Schwarting and Mr. Snyder. And that went up to the Court of Appeals, and they affirmed. So they've had that relationship, that attorney-client relationship, where they know what's happening, they know what Mr. Snyder is going to be doing. And the affidavits that Mr. Schwarting and the other appellants filed in this case in opposition to summary judgment, they're significant for what they don't say. Nowhere do they say, we weren't happy with the communication with our attorney. He wasn't talking to us about issues that we wanted to be clued in on. Nothing about that relationship. In fact, everything about that relationship was fine. And that goes back to the nature of clients. Some clients want to be
I beg your pardon. I beg your pardon. Some little while ago, you and members of the court were referring to the Wood case. In the context of settlement, what are we to take away from that? That holding was limited to settlement, but that the concept could be extended to litigation or filings or appeals? Or is it your view that Wood is limited just to settlement?
Our position is Wood is just limited to settlement, and we believe that's the way it should be. In the very first case this morning, Justice Castle talked about a bigger picture. That fits into this. There's a bigger picture if now we're going to require lawyers to have to contact and talk to a client about every single issue involved in a piece of litigation. That's not practical and it's not reasonable. Clients don't want to be bothered oftentimes with that. But
I beg your pardon, is it the big picture that we should decide this on, or are there any principles of law with respect to the duties of care by a lawyer at the various stages? So if Wood speaks to settlement, that's relevant, but it may not speak to filing an appeal or the potential that your appeal might be dismissed. So I'm trying to find a principle of law that would or would not require a lawyer to visit with the clients to say, I'm not naming some folks. I'll take my chances.
I think this court has wisely limited Wood to settlement. in those six cases since Wood have all been limited to settlement. Because if we don't, where do we go? How far do we go? Then lawyers are constantly asking the question, okay, is this a question that I need to go to my client? Is this something I need to get informed consent about? Do we need to talk about this? And virtually there's no...
Actually, in this case, Mr. Snyder had notice, as Mr. Bruno talked about, considerable notice, Mr. Domina, about the need perhaps to name citizen objectors. How does that factual situation, this particular case, play out?
Again, I hope we can't, we don't go down the road that I have to listen to everything my adversary tells me about a case. And again, I think that's the road we're going down. This was a political storm. That political storm was going to take the licenses from these clients at some point in time. Mr. Snyder was trying to avoid that. And he had the strategy that if I can quiet those political voices, which means the protesters, if they're not necessary parties on appeal, why do I include them? Because all they're going to do is foster and promote that political storm. And instead, my strategy is if I can quiet them, I can go back here and I can show that that commission abused their discretion. And I can get the district court to find that, which he did. And the commission abused their discretion because there are clear statutory criteria for how you renew or not renew a license. And this commission went beyond that and made their decision based upon inadequate law enforcement. So he knew that he had a very good chance and that it was in the best interest of his clients to get rid of the political storm and focus on the commission. And he was successful in that. The district court disagreed with the commission for that very same reason.
Have any other states gone down the road, as you have suggested, and drawn the line about client notification somewhere other than settlement issues?
No.
Is there any law somewhere for us to look at?
And that's why I believe the ABA model rules are relevant. Those were cited in a Wood case. They've been cited other places. And again, there is no red line rule, red line that we can implement. And I think that's why other states have not done that, because it becomes too difficult to say, how far are we going to go with this? All the different things that I have to do as a lawyer in terms of contacting and getting consent from my clients. Nebraska's been very prudent in saying there are three areas that we get informed consent in terms of disclosing confidential information, limited scope representation, and blanking on the third one, conflicts of interest. And that's it. And that's very similar to what the ABA model rules do as well. So I think it is dangerous to say that, okay, we're going to draw a line. And in these particular situations, you have to go talk to your client, because that line will always move, and it will always continue to move. What the rules foster is communication. And that communication has to take place based upon the relationship that's built between the attorney and client. And here we had a long-term relationship. Mr. Schwarting trusted Mr. Snyder. He knew what Mr. Snyder was going to do. They'd already been through an identical process as this. And obviously, because Mr. Schwarting asked Mr. Snyder to represent him in this case, that would tell us that he was satisfied. His expectations were satisfied. And that sometimes is important in terms of clients. My time is up. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
1 minute.
Thank you.
46 seconds. Mr. Bruno.
Mr. Olson used the term dangerous. I think what's dangerous is the precedent that could be set from this case. If you listen to Mr. Snyder's argument, it's basically like, I didn't have to listen to what David Domina had to say. I didn't have to look at the authority he cited to me. I didn't have to consider it at all. In fact, I didn't even have to look at the statute that I cited as the basis for my petition to the court to determine whether or not I'm naming the correct parties. I certainly didn't have to talk to my own clients.
I don't care what they say. Why should I involve them in the decision? Because once I make a decision on their behalf, even though I knew or should have known it could be the wrong decision, there is nothing they can do about it because I have immunity. That is not the law in Nebraska, and that is not the state. Mr. Olson tried to paint Mr. Snyder as the victim here. He is not the victim. He made a critical mistake that cost my clients their business and livelihoods, and he made a mistake for no reason other than possibly arrogance because he was right and everybody else is wrong. But he wasn't.
I beg your pardon. I think opposing counsel is saying in part that Mr. Snyder saw perhaps the lay of the land legally and made a trial strategy choice not to include the objectors because that would be make the proceeding before the court tidier and more likely to be successful. The alternative may have been, as a matter of trial strategy, well, in the old days when lawyers were just men, we used to say belt and suspenders. You would put the folks in because you didn't know how it would come out, so you would cover yourself as a practitioner. But here, the argument seems to be an awareness that the law was perhaps in doubt, but it was a choice. Does that impact your analysis?
It actually supports my analysis, because if there was some uncertainty by Mr. Snyder, what he should have done is explain the uncertainty, why he felt it was uncertain, told the clients of the options available to them, the risks and detriments of each, and allowed the clients to make the decision. That is not only the rule in Wood, but it's the rule in the cases and authority cited in Wood. And if I can, I will leave you with that. And it says, if a client is to meaningfully make that decision on an unsettled issue, he or she needs to have the information necessary to assess the risks and benefits. This is a quote. A lawyer should exert his or her best efforts to ensure that decisions of a client are made only after the client has been informed of all relevant considerations. And if the clients were told that there was any possibility that their appeal could be dismissed, they would have said, absolutely, you're going to include the citizen objectors. And I apologize for going over the time. I just wanted to answer your question. I'd be happy to answer anybody else's.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments in Kozel versus Snyder. Counsel, you are excused, or you may remain. We will, court is adjourned, but we will now have a period of questions and